I came into this conversation wanting to know about how to get into growing tropical plants in a cold climate, because Steve is growing tropical plants, not just subtropical plants, but tropical plants outdoors in a place that gets hail and frost. I came away learning so much more than I thought I would, and I'm excited to share this episode with you because we're talking about so much more than just growing tropical plants. We cover air layering, using bananas as mineral accumulators, why banana lollies taste a certain way, frost protectors, and mulching like crazy. Do not be confused by Steve's humble and casual nature. This man knows his stuff, albeit self-taught, and as usual, I can't listen to the interview because I get too excited and extroverted and want to throw in my two cents, but I hope that you will love this conversation I have with Steve and his experience with Tropo as much as I did.
My name's Steve Fawcett, and I head up a charity in Te Puke called Vector Group Charitable Trust. And under that charity, we have an initiative for kai resilience. And under that, we have a whole bunch of things. One of them is called Tropo, which is basically a tropical urban food forest here in Te Puke. And we've set that up as a kind of a demonstration of what you can do in a small space. I've always kind of been into plants because growing up in the islands in Papua New Guinea, you're surrounded by tropical plants and bananas and mangoes and star fruit. And I guess it reminds me of where I'm from, who I am, and it kind of like ties me back to, you know, the good old days when I was a kid mucking around and just climbing any kind of tree and just gorging, you know, ourselves as kids on tropical fruit. And I know Te Puke isn't a tropical town, but yeah, I guess I thought I'd try it. And at the same time, try it and learn from it and use that learning for other growing things and putting into the community.
Where did you move to New Zealand?
So I was born and raised in Papua New Guinea up until about 12 and a half years, and then moved to Australia. My mum's Australian, my father's Kiwi. They were missionaries in Papua New Guinea, and spent a few years in Queensland, Brisbane, Queensland, and then came to New Zealand. Jeepers, I don't know what year that was. It was a long time ago. Time flies when you get old.
You've got a Kiwi accent.
Have I?
Yeah.
Mixed.
You don't think you do?
Weird accent. No, I guess, yeah.
You do?
I've lived here for ages, so.
Growing up, I had a grapefruit tree, and I always think about that grapefruit tree. We'd pick the fruit, and then we'd be on the trampoline, we'd be just covered in grapefruit juice. And it's really funny, you talking about growing these fruits for your childhood memories. I'm obsessed with growing a decent grapefruit tree, and I haven't been able to do it yet. People keep giving me dwarf stock. I'm like, I'm in a rural valley. What are you doing?
Yeah, you want a big one.
And I want a big one.
Yeah.
And one that can fend for itself too.
Yeah.
Not a little baby that needs five steaks.
Yeah.
Yeah. And another question then, with kai resilience, why food forests in terms of kai resilience? Why not growing a vegetable bed?
I think that goes back to my childhood as well. I think formation in early years is a big thing. And, you know, going to photography, I saw my dad doing photography and had his own room for developing and stuff like that, and so the interest grew there. But in regards to plants, I guess, you know, you're in a tropical jungle and it's not a monoculture. It's like so much diversity, not just animal life but also plant life. And I guess being in those villages and seeing all the different foods that were eaten, and you know, like you go to a supermarket here and you'll see cauliflower or broccoli or whatever, and mm-hmm. It's just the actual head that's used, not the leaves. And but over in the islands, it's like everything gets utilized. And yeah, I didn't want to go for that monoculture or orchard type thing where you've got all the same types of trees. And I guess because I'm obsessed with plants and all different types of plants and rare plants, you can't really have a monoculture with that sort of
attitude.
Yeah. With that sort of like really bad obsession.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I could not agree more. the worst thing we could do is monocrop one plant, like in terms of kite resilience, eh?
Yeah.
Even in the supermarket, even for health, I mean, it's sprayed with pesticides. We're taking one part of the plant, like you said in the case of cauliflower. I went onto Pack and Save website a few months ago and there were 8 possible fruits that you could buy. I was like, this is the middle of summer.
Yeah, right.
I think, well, it must have been a few months ago now in the middle of winter. I was like, why are there 8 fruits available? Grapes was one of them and none of them were New Zealand grapes. One of them was apples and it was like several different cultivators of apples. And it's just such a shame. There's 50,000 plants we can eat, I've read.
Wow.
I tend to think of New Zealand as temperate climate or maybe subtropical. And you're growing tropical. You've also got some Mediterranean and tropo, I noticed.
Yeah.
And some subtropical.
Yeah, there is definitely diversity here. A lot of different plants. And I guess probably too, I don't have any like formal training with plants. And I haven't studied academically or even had that physical hands-on experience in orchards or anything like that. So when I started here, it's kind of like it was a blank canvas and it was like, oh, that looks like a cool plant to grow. Stick that in. And then, yeah, I guess when I started putting all the plants in and I had a really small space because most of it was gravel out there, and I guess with all the plants and the closeness of putting all the plants in there, it kind of follows the syntropic agroforestry line of planting with succession and stuff like that. But because I had done no training or any workshops or followed any syntropic agroforestry, the movement, it's kind of just been a wing it,
ad hoc.
Try it. If it doesn't grow, if it fails, just try again. Just try a different method. Yeah.
You were telling me, and you were showing me, when we went to the quick tour before, long tour, sorry, because I asked him many questions, air rooting, and you were suggesting that your plants go into flower.
Yeah.
Can you tell me a tiny bit more about that?
Yes.
I think it's really interesting.
So the whole point of the air layering, I get it was. I didn't set out to like set this experiment and to see what would happen. It was more along the lines that I knew how to clone plants, like from a little cutting and multiply them, but I'd never tried air layering. And some plants are really, really expensive. So you buy one and it might be like $250 for a little plant, and then you kill it. And then, so you need to learn to be able to like multiply that plant and put it in different areas to make sure that it's going to survive. So I started getting to air layering, but what I discovered was that I think the first thing I air layered was my variegated calamansi. And when I air layered it, the branch that I air layered began to flower. The rest of the plant wasn't flowering, it was just that on that one branch. And I was like, oh, that's weird, anomaly. And then I tried it on the star fruit and it did the same thing. And then I tried it on the Kikot, tropical apricot, and it did the same thing. And then the ingabean, and it did the same thing. So, and then on the Jabotacabra as well, which usually take years to flower, yeah, they all triggered. And I was like, oh, that's strange. So not knowing, you know, the whys and the wherefores behind it, it was just an experiment that I just wanted to clone and multiply my plants, but then I discovered that it actually also triggers early flowering.
Mm.
Yeah, which is pretty exciting.
Do you air like for me, with mostly Mediterranean or temperate plants, should I be air layering them, or is it just easier to take a cutting?
Air layering is probably the most guaranteed way that you're going to get rooted, especially on, it depends, like figs, there's no point because figs are really easy to propagate, or berries are easy, like there's a lot of plants that are like easy to propagate, but things like citrus can take quite a long time, Jabotacabras are a nightmare, Some plants, like some native plants like kowhai in there, they take a long time to root.
Yes.
So it's better to have them ear layering than just taking cuttings.
So we can ear layer natives?
Yeah, I've done it
with kowhai.
Yeah, I've done it with kowhai.
I had 6 kakabeek and 1 took. No, that's not true. I bought them as seedlings and they all grow and the snails and such came and destroyed them. And so now I've got one that I protect fiercely.
Yeah.
And I could ear layer it.
Yeah.
Just scrape off the bark, swirl, bag, tape.
Yep, you just remove the cambium layer, don't go too deep. There's actually a little tool that you can get from Farmlands.
Mm-hmm.
It looks like a pair of scissors type thing. You just clamp it together and then you just put it on the branch and you fling it around the branch and it takes a really neat cut, mm-hmm. the branch layer off.
Mm-hmm.
And then you just wrap that with soil. Or cocoa core or some sort of medium that'll retain a little bit of moisture but not too much moisture and won't dry out.
Because you don't want to ring bark it.
Well, you are, and you are really ring barking it.
You're ring barking it, but then because there's soil there, the roots come out rather than the oxygen.
If you constantly ring bark something like running a weed eater around the bottom of a tree, like a citrus tree, you'll kill it. But if you do it like once, it'll repair, and if it's not too far apart, when they ring bark a tree to kill it, that's quite a lot of the outside bark layer that they've removed.
Right.
But when you're ear layering, you're only removing like a little section because it's the top cut that the roots actually set from. So you don't need a big cut. You just need to stop that flow of whatever the heck it is that goes up and down the plant.
That, maybe?
Yeah, that stuff.
The life force.
Yeah.
Cool.
The non-academic version.
I'm going to... No, neither of us are scientists or formal training. We just like growing things that are cool.
Yeah.
I'm going to try it. Maybe I'll do it on a grapefruit tree.
Yeah. So what is interesting is since I started ear layering and found out that it triggers early flower, I then discovered that in the kiwifruit industry here in Te Puke, they also do it. It's called girdling. And what they do is they girdle the kiwifruit usually to induce early flower. Hello. And then secondly, they do it a second time once the fruit's on to increase the size of the fruit because the nutrients can't flow through that cambium layer back into the roots. It gets stuck in the fruit, so the fruit become bigger. So yeah, that was an interesting little bit of learning, which I learnt by tiptoeing around and experimenting, and then later out found out through, you know, Google.
Mm.
I should have searched first.
Nah.
Maybe Google first and then try later.
You got to do something fun.
Yeah.
Oh, well, I mean, what you were cloning it and then you realised also there was early fruiting. You wouldn't have known to Google.
No.
If you hadn't already. I mean, I never thought that there would be a way of making a tree fruit early.
Yeah, and since then, like other people on the tropical fruit page and that have said that, yeah, it can, it triggers like a stress characteristic in the tree, and so it thinks it's going to die, and so it quickly produces flower and fruit to produce seed so that it can replicate itself.
Certainly seems to happen to my sad plants. Like I had lemon grass go to seed and someone said if your lemon grass has gone to seed it's dying. It attracted and died. It was too much frost. Okay, so my next question then is, if I'm living in a temperate climate, which most of New Zealand is, except for the far north and maybe some beach homes. What's step one? Like if I was a beginner, which I am, and I want to grow tropical plants, what's my first step? Growing indoors? Should I be growing indoors? Should I be getting a glasshouse? Should I start there?
Yeah, I think a number of things. One, I went with tunnels because it's cheaper. Like you can get a tunnel from Trade Tested for like $240 or some ridiculous price, 3x2. And so that was my first port of call, was getting a tunnel. But I found that in wintertime they don't hold enough heat. In summertime, even with the green, you know, tinge on them, they still get way too hot. You got to have the doors open, and in some cases you got to have fans and extractors as well, because they just get way, way too hot. So yeah, I think going greenhouse, if you've got the money, then definitely you need a greenhouse, especially if you want to grow tropicals or anything like that. Especially in the early stages, once they get a little bit bigger and they can handle it, they kind of get a bit resilient and they can, you can go outside. But for frost, hard frost and cold weather like that, you really need overstory. You need to have some sort of plant that's over the top, or plant beside your house or beside a fence that's kind of like going to give it a bit of protection.
I've heard frost moves like molasses, and then it kind of can sit like molasses and move down hills like molasses.
Oh.
Kay Baxter talks about that.
I've not really studied frost. Yeah.
And it kind of tracks with my property, where you can see it sit and then you can see it run down the hill. And if there's a barrier, like a tree or even a bit of log on the ground, the frost will kind of go around it.
Oh.
And the log's given protection to the few metres past it that's on the ground.
Right.
I've noticed even my small trees, there's no frost underneath.
Yeah.
Well, you know, well, like the trampoline, right? There's no frost under the tramp, but the tramp itself's covered in frost.
Yeah.
So would you recommend, if you're starting to plant tropical plants outside, having a canopy first of some kind? Either living or cloth or...
Yeah, some sort of canopy, even if it's makeshift, like, you know, whether it's a tunnel or whether it's a fast-growing tree. Some movements, you know, like the syntropic agroforestry will get you to plant different tree types, like eucalyptus and you know, bunner grass and a whole bunch of things that grow really quickly and give you that cover in the initial stages. But for me, because I was in an urban property, there's no point growing all those syntropic plants, because I'd have no room for anything else.
No.
If you're on a big property, then fine, you plant away and go for gold. But I guess that's another thing. I didn't know which trees grew quick and which didn't. And I found that out by just planting stuff out. Inga beans are super quick to grow if they've got full sun. Japanese raisin trees are like supersonic. Even feijoas are fast. And when I first started, I had a row just of feijoas that were protecting my little tropicals coming up, like longan and lychee and mangoes and that sort of thing. And that worked well. But yeah, you definitely need a canopy. And another really good one because I didn't know what grew quick, I knew bananas grew really quick. And so I put bananas everywhere. I had bananas probably spacings of about 5 meters in between each plot. And that basically covered the whole area in leaves. And when I did have cold weather, those leaves took the brunt of everything.
Mm.
And then everything underneath was fine.
And then the banana leaves, the top leaves die back.
Top leaves get all, shriveled up brown. And brown and horrible. And then in spring, all the new ones come out, and then you just trim them back and they look fine again.
Yeah.
When I first started, I was like really precious about how plants looked. You know, like if a banana leaf got a little split in it from the wind or...
Yeah.
And... you just learn that plant's designed to, you know, shred like that.
Yeah.
And, you know, for high wind situations and cyclones and that sort of thing. So you learn to accept that the ugliness of that plant is actually, like, why it survives.
It's part of the goodness of the plant.
Yeah,
I like that too. I've had to take a few ego pills for that, where people will come to my garden and I'm thinking, man, I wish you could see it on this date, you know, when it looked so good. Or I'll have a root crop and the garden will look like a garden full of weeds, but I know underneath it's full of yams and everything else, eh?
Yeah.
And you do, if you are working with nature, you're not going to get the monocrop look. It's not going to look like a pretty paddock of broccoli.
No.
It's going to look like nature.
Yeah.
And then you're working with nature and it seems like a lot easier. Maybe easier is not the right word. I'm hoping it's easier. It's more sustainable one day for me.
Yeah. I think the easier route too, that's another reason why I didn't go the syntropic way, because I saw so much, like, there's some videos out there of, like, the amount of work that people have to do to maintain, like, chop and drop bunna grass, all that sort of thing. And because I didn't have the space, I never had to have it. Basically, all the plants out there are the ones that I actually want, or are plants that are going to bear fruit. And it doesn't look pretty all year, because a lot of tropicals and non-tropicals drop leaves in winter, and so, yeah.
Yeah, that's true. You don't have any companion plants, what you hear. You know, you hear a lot in food forests, or read in food forest books, where you need so many companion plants for the one fruiting plant. And I've been following that method a little bit, but if I'm honest, I only want the fruiting plants. I mean, if it's a cool companion plant, sure. I like the nitrogen fixes. I really like the look of Corphi. I've got some red dogwood, for example, which is the chopper drop, and that's kind of cool. I made a basket using that last week.
Yeah.
But I like the idea of just having the things you want. And like you said, like the bananas are going to die back. They're designed to do that anyway. Yeah, that's food for thought. I like that idea. I think especially if you're suburban, you don't need to grow a gum tree. It's going to take up the whole backyard.
Yeah, like the sort of floss that I've got out there, which, you know, when it flowers, it's going to be pretty, but that thing will grow massive if I don't keep on top of it.
Well, I was trying to find out the definition difference between tropical and subtropical climates, which is so silly. I had to Google this, but tropical plants literally come from the tropics. So Tropic of Cancer to Capricorn, so that middle section.
So you know more than me.
Yeah, I had to Google that, and I was like, oh, that's what the lines on the globe are. The tropical lines, and then just under that's the subtropical. And yeah, we have subtropical climate very north in New Zealand.
Yeah, right.
Maybe down to Auckland along the coastline. And other than that, it's temperate. So you're growing two climates up from temperate, which I think is impressive, especially to be growing them. Do we want to talk any more about growing outdoors? So for a food forest tropical or subtropical guild, i.e. frost hardy upper story, using wind cloth, glass house, cold frame, frost manipulation, other design considerations, is there anything else you want to add?
Probably I guess I see it in a lot of people that are wanting to grow, but they put growing off for years and years because they're like doing these eternal plans, the perfect plan. There ain't no perfect plan, and you're gonna have a lot of plants die. But I think one of the biggest things I found was that a lot of the plants are actually more hardier than what you think they are. And I found that plants in the ground outside did better than sometimes even slightly heated or in tunnels. Mm. Like my mangoes. Mangoes can be really difficult because they get like this fungal disease, and in a tunnel it's just a nightmare to try and keep the thing alive. And my gosh, I lost quite a few of them. But you know, mangoes outside are doing fine here, which is really surprising. And a lot of plants are actually doing really well, like black sapotes, and all these plants I didn't realize, you know, at the time when I got them, that they'd actually handle quite cold temperatures. It's just that frost. It's the frost is the not good one. That, like, a lot of plants can handle cold, but when it gets frosty and then the sun in the morning, it's not good.
But is the frost, am I right in thinking the frost is in the plant, and then when it heats up it expands, and that's how it damages the plant?
Yeah, I don't actually know. I've not actually researched it. I just try and keep that frost away.
Here we go. Frost freezes the water inside plants, which expands, ruptures the cell walls, and leaves plants limp and blackened once they thaw. They're not a problem for Mediterranean plants or temperate plants because they've evolved to adapted by losing their leaves or whatever they do. Subtropicals hate them, and tropicals surely just keel over and die.
Right.
Was what I thought. And I noticed, so with your bananas, you're not two-phased, because do bananas die back every year anyway?
Bananas, once they flower, they're after they've flowered and fruited. If you leave the stem, it'll get reabsorbed into the actual banana plot. But yeah, basically they're replenishing themselves. So like, it's not like a palm tree, for example. If the palm tree dies in the center, it's history because it's not going to reproduce another pup or anything like that. Whereas bananas are fine. They're always like pumping out more pups or more leaves. As long as it hasn't flowered yet, it'll keep pumping out fresh leaves for spring and summer.
Yeah.
So
and if it has flowered, you might as well leave it there to protect the plants underneath.
Yeah. Well, once it flowers and fruits, you still got all those leaves on there. And the thing is that it acts as a frost cover, but it's also giving you fruit.
Yeah.
Whereas, and the bonus of the banana as well is that it's full of potassium, the whole plant is. And so when you chop that thing down and after you chop and drop, it's a really good feeder anyway. So a good feeder for flowering. Potassium is really good for flowering.
Yeah.
And
for fruit set? Is potassium good for fruit set? Yeah.
Flowering and fruit.
Brilliant. You did a post recently that said the holy grail of a subtropical food forest, growing the truly tropical pawpaw, as it's known in New Zealand and Australia, or papaya elsewhere. Carrick papaya, so you call it?
Yeah.
And not to be confused with the mountain pawpaw, babaco, or American pawpaw. I can see the appeal in having fruit that is beyond the supermarket, spray-free, grown to ripeness. And my question to you, what are your most prized possessions or the hardest to grow? What are you most proud of? Firstly, I know that this isn't what you trained in or you're not a scientist, but you know a lot about the plants. Like even to know that, I mean, even just to identify all the plants to start with, let alone knowing, well, you know, you can let the middle of the banana tree die, but you can't let the middle of a palm tree die, so I'm going to put a blanket over in the middle of the night or when the frost is going to hit. You know a lot. So you've obviously just, you've grown up with them, you've done some Googling, and then you just learn on the way.
Yeah, well, like across the road, the neighbour had this palm tree that he treasured, and it got hit last year, I think it was, and the centre rotted, and that was the end of it, and it was a big palm. A cool looking palm.
Yeah.
But he lost it, and that could have been saved just from one blanket or, you know, and so I've not just learned from Googling, I've also learned from other people by observing and seeing. And I guess that's why I'm really precious with my coconut. Like if I know, I've had so many coconuts that the centre frong has like rotted out and then I've lost it. Once that centre goes, your history.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Whereas banana, that whole thing can rot, like disappear into nothingness. But below the soil is the corms, and those things are just waiting for spring and summer.
Yeah.
Waiting for some heat, and then they'll be like taken off.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So learning from community, from your neighbour, but also other people that are growing similar things.
Yeah.
What's your favourite plant?
Probably favourite fruiting plant, two of them probably cherimoya and white sapote.
Yeah.
My favourite looking plant, probably my rarest one would be my Mossonano, which is a variegated banana. And I'm really interested to see the fruit on that, whether it's going to be pink and green variegated as well. Because I've got pink bananas.
It would be so cool. Also, just pink bananas are cool.
Yeah, I've got the Mossa Valentino, which is a dwarf pink banana, which is like little hairy, furry, velvety. It's called the pink velvet banana, right? Because the skin is quite velvety.
Yeah. Is it yummy?
No, it's full of seed and tastes horrible. it's classed, they say it's edible. It's classed ornamental, but they say it's edible, but it really is not edible.
That means it's not toxic. It
doesn't taste that great.
Mm.
You know the banana pith, the white stuff that's down the side of a banana and it kind of leaves it. Well, basically the whole banana, the pink velvet, tastes like that. There's no sweetness, just that pith taste. Okay. Yeah.
So not toxic, but not particularly.
But so many seeds, oh my gosh. That's like, those things like pup prolifically and seed prolifically.
Mm.
Yeah.
Do you know, I listened to an entire podcast once on the banana lolly. You know, like banana lollies.
Oh, right. Yeah, yeah.
Actually were based on a previous cultivator that used to be worldwide.
Oh.
And then it got wiped out by a disease. And now we have the Cavalier. What is it now?
Banana lolly.
You know the banana lollies. Like, every time you eat a banana lolly, you know what it's going to taste like.
Yeah, horrible.
Banana candy. But it doesn't actually taste like banana that you get from the supermarket.
Yeah, right.
Well, the flavour, apparently, is based on a previous cultivator that people were... that people would still be able to recognise now. But it got wiped out by a disease. I have to fact stamp that.
Well, that banana lolly kind of... it's got that kind of flowery taste to it, eh? Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah,
you know those little yellow bananas that you buy in a lolly packet?
Yes, but also fruit bursts, banana lollies, or anything banana flavoured.
Oh, right.
It has a flavour to it that doesn't taste like the cultivator of bananas you get from supermarket now. Are they called Cavendish?
Cavendish or?
Cavendish, thank you. All my mistakes, I'm going to edit out and all your ones, I'll leave them. All right, this is what someone asked. Okay. If I struggle with radiant frosts rather than legit sub-zero frost, so that is the hot ground swaps with cold air too quickly and the condensation settles on the leaves, then would things like stones and rocks under my trees to try and retain the heat of the day be counterproductive? So do we want to use things like stones, etc.?
Yeah, so I've got a coconut, you saw the coconut out there, and I've got like, so I had this idea of like putting big river stones around it just to, as an extra heat absorption. And I put stones around, like rocks around a lot of my tropicals when I first began. I think it's got to work. It's got to do something, right? Because it's causing more spatial distance between, say, cold air and the bottom of the rock. You know, so it's like it's creating more distance from the roots up the plant. Secondly, it absorbs heat, some sort of heat. It's got to, even if it's like minimal, it's absorbing something, right?
Mm.
It's got to be. I think mulching was a really good one. Like, I mulched that whole line really thickly, and that helped. But having a lot of plants, overstory and also under. Like, for example, a lot of tropicals don't like having wet feet when it's cold. Like, they can handle wet feet in the islands, right? Because it's tropical, it's like raining constantly for like half the year. Yeah, they can handle wet feet.
Yeah.
But they just can't handle it when it's cold. And so I've put a lot of even indoor plants, like monsterias and variegated monsterias, plants that I like. And I've put them, like, even indoor plants that you might get from Mitre 10, you put them along the bottom, and what that does is it helps draw the moisture out of the soil around, you know, during winter time. I guess everything's been an experiment.
Yeah.
Just trying multiple things,
yeah,
multiple ways of doing things. But I think mulch is a big one. My bananas definitely helped.
Yeah. What do you use to mulch?
When I first mulched that, because that basically that line out, that whole area out there was just grass with grass grub in it, and I just got mulch from the landscape suppliers, and it was just basically bark.
Right.
It was a lot of bark.
Yeah.
It was so much bark. Ridiculous. That was another mistake I did. What I did was I did this big long line, and I used sheets of black polythene plastic. I didn't run a whole full sheet, because then you've got to like cut holes in it, right, and put your plants around it. So I did like segments of, say, like 60 centimeters long, and then I put them down, and then I put a plant, and then I put another sheet down and put a plant. And so I did that, and I mulched the whole lot really thick, like probably, oh my gosh, probably 20 to 30 centimeters thick of mulch on top of the plastic, right? Because I wanted it to retain moisture and also create, like, you know, when mulch breaks down, it creates some heat, especially fresh fresh mulch. And so I wanted to create heat and all that kind of stuff. But then I, after doing it all and thinking it was a great idea, I realized, oh, the plastic, it's not going to let water through into the roots.
No.
Right?
Yeah.
But it was a mistake I made, but lucky I chopped the plastic into, like, pieces, because then I was able to just pull the plastic out and the mulch stayed there.
Yeah.
And so I ended up, which was good, because what the plastic had done, it had killed all, I didn't actually cultivate any of that dirt. Like, it was just crappy lawn, right? But when I pulled the mulch out, all the grass was dead and the mulch just fell down, you know, where the plastic had been. And then it's ended up, like, you can, like, where all those pineapples and all that were along that line, you could see there was no weeds. That was done like 3 years ago.
Yeah.
Yeah, so.
Great. What I've done at my place is lay down the black plastic, and then once the grass is dead, because I've got kikuyu, moved it and then done the cardboard and mulch.
Yeah.
I don't know why the cardboard. I think just for an extra level, like another 6 months of protection, you know?
Yeah, right.
So, and you don't have to blow phosphate. You don't have to spray everything.
Yeah, so, like, even though it was a big mistake of putting plastic down, right?
Yeah.
And it was a big fail.
In terms of
the, like, the plants not getting water when it rained.
Yeah.
That was another thing that I discovered that, oh, man, that really annihilated that grass in the area.
Yeah.
And then the mulch just went down, and I didn't use any cardboard in there at all, and it's worked out fine.
I wonder if I could get away without using cardboard, because it's kind of a pain. I go to the bike shops, or I go to, like, Farmlands or Falloons up our way and get the big sheets they put on the pallets.
Right.
Because there's no plastic sellotape or
staples
or anything on them. But it's a lot of trips, you know. Maybe I can just get rid of the cardboard. But, yeah, an example of a try something, kind of failed a little bit at one side, one end, but you learned something.
Yeah.
All right, one more. If my supposedly cold-tolerant tropos, like my hardy, hairy tamarillos, lose all their leaves during the winter cold, is it okay? Are they going to bounce back? And will they still be able to bear fruit even with their leaves gone? So I guess the answer here is it depends on the plant.
Tamarillos?
Yeah, tamarillos.
I'd recommend getting a flamethrower and burning them things to them.
Really? Not frost-tolerant? Then you don't like tamarillos,
they're a nightshade, and oh my gosh, they are really problematic plants. They attract everything. They're stinky. They're stinky as well. They're like the woolly nightshade plant that is the weed that grows all over New Zealand. Same family.
They're so tomatoes.
I know, but they're smelly as well. And they're prone to the same thing. Same with potatoes, saloon, whitefly. Tamarillos usually lose leaves in winter, like a cold winter anyway, and they'll come back.
Yeah.
They're really easy to propagate if you just chop the stem and plop them somewhere else.
You just chop the stem.
Yeah, they just need a bit of heat. Like, spring is the best time to propagate, unless you've got, like, grow tents or you've got heated areas, which costs money to run. And you want to try avoid that.
What is something that I haven't asked you that you think, oh, I wish she'd asked me that, I wish we could talk about this? Anything come to mind?
Oh, there's so much. My goodness. I think probably, don't fear failure, and experiment, and don't fear, like, somebody observing you and going, oh, look at him, he failed doing that or whatever. Probably one of the biggest things that I've recognised when having, like, food forest events and gatherings is that people are really scared. It's like this fear of, a big one is fear of failure, fear of the unknown, fear of not doing something the most perfect way, killing plants and all that kind of stuff. And I've seen people that have been, going along to workshops and stuff like that for, like, years, like 3, 4, 5 years before they've even planted anything out, and they spend so much time planning and don't actually get anything in the ground. Just get stuff in the ground, and if it's not growing that good, then just dig it up and put it somewhere else. Like, that's what I've had to do. And I guess I think with, like, growing a monoculture, you know exactly, like, that one plant, that one particular citrus or that one particular plum, you know exactly what it needs. You know the soil it needs, the drainage it needs, the temperatures, all that. But when you've got a garden that's so diverse, like, some things hate heat, some things love it, some things hate cold, you know, like, you've got so many different plants and they're all, like, you know, like, trying to survive together, I think it's really hard to plan something like that out.
Yeah.
So yeah, don't be scared, don't be shy to try something, just try it. And like, a lot of my knowledge has come from like failure, you know, like failure at cuttings, taking cuttings of certain things like citrus and kofi, and then why is this not successful, so let's try airlowing.
Yeah,
you know, and then, you know, trying hydroponics, and then trying DWC, and then RDWC, and then auto pots with cocoa, and you know, like I've tried everything, and I guess you got to try, and that's how you learn. Well, that's how I learn. I learn by trial and error. Yeah.
There's only so much textbook, and pen to paper, and conferences and workshops you can go to before you actually have to put something in the soil and observe it and be with it.
Yeah, and you might know everything, you know, theoretically. But then when it comes to, I guess it comes down to the whole movement of permaculture as well. They were really dubious about the academic side, where it seemed that there was no practicality or practical, and, you know, like, you know, it's all theory, but you've never planted a tomato plant.
Yeah.
And I think that there's, like, I think there's room for both academia and also but yeah, I guess it depends on your learning style as well. And I don't like reading instructions. Like, I'm the sort of guy that will just try it, and then if I fail, I'll read the instructions. Yeah, right,
where did I put them?
Right at the end, or Google right at the end.
Yeah.
I'll try something first, but other people will, like, they'll read the instructions and they'll get it right the first time.
Yeah.
You know, and I'll be like, damn it, I should have read those instructions.
Yeah. Yeah.
But my learning style is like that. I just, yeah, try something and learn that way.
Yeah. I love that. Good advice. I think it's great advice. And I like what you said about it won't look perfect necessarily, but it could be, yeah, you know, that's been a huge thing for me, is this isn't going to look a certain way. I mean, obviously a happy plant looks a certain way, but if you're growing for nutrient-dense food, you're growing to enjoy the plant, eat from the plant, okay, if it's sad in the winter for a couple months, but its nutrients are in the roots and it's going to come back up again, then it's happy. And it's not really about, is it photo-worthy today?
Yeah.
And, like, kind of losing that idea of perfection, because nature's not perfect. There's always something dying, something that's little growing, something in the middle, and something that's happy.
Yeah.
It's always a mixture of all the things. If people want to follow you, if they want to buy from you, if they want to support your charity, what should they do?
Well, they can just do a Google search. And
of Troppo.
Yeah, of Troppo or Victor Group Charitable Trust, or just search plant stuff in Te Puke or my name, Steve Fawcett, and I'll come up.
Okay.
Hopefully there's not too much bad stuff out there of being online.
Maybe there will be after this podcast release.
Yeah, maybe.
And I'll put some links into the show notes as well.
Yeah, cool.
Thanks, Dee.
No worries.
I said I would fact stamp my story about banana candy, and yes, many banana lollies are based on a banana cultivator that was sold worldwide up until the 1950s. The Gross Michael had a high concentration of isomyl acetate, which is the chemical compound used to flavour banana candy. Then Panama disease spread through plantations and growers switched to Cavendish bananas. This is ironic because Cavendish bananas are currently under threat from a different strain, which the Gross Michael didn't face. So now you know, A, why they taste the way they do, and B, why we need to save heritage variety of seeds and not rely on monocropping. If you enjoyed this episode, share it with a friend, because it helps deliver our message of living in harmony with nature.